Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. The supply closet. I found the journal of a ghost hunter in the supply closet at my job. It documented some of his cases, and for now we're going to refer to him as John Doe. On the first page, where the author's signature should have appeared, somebody had scratched it out with a thick, pointed black pen. On the top right corner of the page was a crudely drawn eye with three upside-down pyramids attached to the lower lid. Also noteworthy is the word Lenore. The writing's legible and not that of John Doe, which appeared on the pages several times. The first entry was dated February 2nd. You don't know true fear until you've walked Euclid's trail in the middle of the night with nothing but a flashlight. Jacob, the local librarian, strongly believes that the place is haunted, even possessed, and should one choose to drive out there after dark, one would see and hear some strange things, in his words. Question is, do I take this on? I have seen a thing in my life that I have no plausible explanation for, but they ultimately pushed me to become what I am today. If there is one thing I have learned from all these years, it is this. You can never be sure of anything until you've seen it yourself. It might seem like the obvious truth, but you'd be surprised at just how much is overlooked. My point is that even the most ridiculous urban legends have a grain of truth to them, and it is this I am after. I did a quick internet search on haunted Euclid in Ohio, but nothing directly related came up. A few rumors of hauntings here and there, but that was about it. I did find an interesting video on a blog titled Lenore about an abandoned hospital in Euclid. Strange thing is, that was the only post on the entire site. Nothing else. I burned it onto a CD to make sure that I have it on me at all times for reference. Second entry dated April 2nd. I did it. Almost anyway. I decided to walk through the woods instead of driving out there so I could get the most out of the experience, but I was still a significant distance away from the I-90 overpass and the actual trail. So I got into my car at about 8 p.m. after having a light dinner and drove two-thirds of the way through Euclid Avenue before cutting onto the I-90. The place was fairly quiet, not much activity on the roads or the common areas I drove by. I reasoned that the locals probably were a similar lot and preferred keeping to themselves. I ran out of gas about a half hour into I-90, worried that I'd have to cut my investigation short before it even began. Thankfully, there was a station a little further ahead, and I figured I'd ask the employees around for inside scoops about the trail. The first person I interviewed was the pump operator, a young man in his early 20s. I pulled out my voice recorder and began talking. I informed him that I was investigating a haunted trail that was around there and looking for more information about its origins and the place it held in the culture of Euclid currently. He looked away for a second, adjusted his cap, and folded his hands across his chest. He then pinpointed the exact location on the map that was resting on my steering wheel and asked me if it was there I was heading. I nodded my head. His face turned grim right then. He was quiet for a few minutes and then he told me to turn my car around and go back to where I had come from. I was a little taken aback by his attitude, but not surprised. I assured him that I would take his advice, only if he'd tell me more about the trail. He seemed to believe me. Euclid's trails housed the remains of a Civil War insane asylum and a children's hospital. As the story went, sometime in the late 1800s, the hospital broke out in flames, taking the lives of many children and soldiers. The woods around the fire pit was where the reported hauntings took place. There was also a large brick bridge somewhere in the forest, dating back to the early 1500s. It was said that after the fire in the hospital, The children who escaped got lost in the woods and had no way to survive. Believing that they were miles away from civilization, they entered into a suicide pact. One by one, they hung themselves off the side of the bridge. He also asserted firmly that the police patrolled the area at nights and usually levied a heavy fine on trespassers. I thanked him for his help, paid the money, and turned my car back onto the road. Ben knew that I wasn't going to take his warning seriously after all, judging by the sigh he gave when I took one last look at him. I found the trail a few minutes later. Unfortunately for me, the police were present there, and I couldn't go in until they dispersed. So here I am instead, sitting in the car, making an entry in my diary. New page. Same date, time, 11:39 p.m. I don't think they'll be staying here for the rest of the night. New page. Time, 3:58 a.m. I'm sitting in the waiting room as I write this. I am not leaving until they find that boy. The trail was not all that frightening. But the noises, they sounded like Elise. It's all in my head. I know this, but when you're in there, it feels so real. And the boy, Frederick, he ran away before I could ask him what he was doing in the woods. I called the police on it, despite knowing that I would also be fined for being a trespasser. But the child's safety was of much more importance to me. I told him about my encounter with him, leaving out one detail. Right before he disappeared, Frederick said something to me. Go to Lenore. I don't know what he meant, but I feel compelled to do something about it. There's this weird feeling in my gut. I know somehow that this is important for me. Date, September 9th. Nothing. They told me they patrolled the area every night, but hadn't seen anybody. Because they'd made sure that nobody would be in there. I reasoned with them, but it quickly turned into an argument of it was just an animal versus the I know what I saw. I'm frustrated. I also keep dreaming about Frederick hurting Elise frequently. Date, October 9th. I'm going back to Euclid with Andy. I have to find the boy. Date, December 9th. We saw Frederick again. This time, he was wearing a faded bunny suit. I switched on my recorder and asked him a few questions. He wouldn't answer, just stared at the space between Andy and I. At one point, I could hear Andy sucking in his breath. That's when I realized that he was afraid of Frederick. So was I. I called out to Frederick again. He opened his mouth as if to say something, but his face contorted into a horrible expression. I saw a white figure flick across the trees, and Frederick snapped his head to the right. But it was gone before he could see what it was. There was a spurt of bright white light beside me where Andy was standing. When I looked back, the boy was gone. Andy had taken a photo. There was nobody in the spot where Frederick stood. Maybe he had disappeared before the flash went off. I don't know. Three pages after this were torn out. The CD John talked about was stuck to the back of the journal with double-sided tape. I will take a look at them and see what they contained. I saw what was contained on that CD, and I wish so much I hadn't. Because now, every night, he comes in my dreams. Yes, after I saw what was on that CD. Frederick visits me in his bunny suit. Elliot's story. Linda Summers was agitated. She shuffled from room to room, tutting and muttering, lifting a paper here, a cardigan there. I stood in the hallway watching her progress through the house, waiting for her to engage with me. My clipboard felt slippery in my sweating hands. I'd left the pet carrier in the entryway. The wee bastard is gone. A fine mist of spittle drifted on the air as the word bastard came out. The bitter decaying scent of gingivitis filled the air, mixing with the general odor of neglect. Linda pushed greasy tendrils of graying hair behind her ears and looked up at me, eyes blazing. Well, do you see him? A fucking Dene. You're out of luck, lassie. I shifted my weight from one foot to the other and looked around. Bloody cat. She was shuffling away again. She picked an unsteady path through the various precarious piles of... what was it? Stuff? Some stuff made some sense. There was a heap of magazines 3 feet high next to a chair. A reading lamp several inches thick with grime and dust. Someone used to sit in that chair and read those magazines, but the chair was all but vanished under a mound of, well, probably clothes, but they looked like rags, with shredded hems and moth-made lace everywhere. Nobody had sat there in a long time. Linda had reached the bathroom and was struggling to force the door, which was standing a little ajar. Her progress was thwarted by something inside. Another mound of stuff, probably. "Give me a hand here," she shrieked at me. I started at the volume and shrillness of her voice and stepped quickly through the debris to help her. She stepped back and I leaned my weight on the door and pushed. Nothing. It was the immovable object. I tried the light switch. Nothing happened. "Do you not have power?" I asked. "Of course I've got power. I'm not a fucking animal. Do I have power? My son pays my power. He loves me. Aye, he does. Not like that bitch. He loves his wee mammy. The bulb is away, is all. Aye, the bulb blew a while back, last week or so, and I've no gotten room to change in it. Do you have power?" She trailed off, her anger suddenly dissipating. "Do you think the cat is in there?" I asked her. She looked confused for a second. "The cat?" She regarded me with a vague, unfocused look for a few seconds. "Oh, the bloody cat." Her mind ground back into motion. "Well, nah, probably not. I've not been able to open that door more than the wee inch since, oh, a good long while. You think he could fit through that gap?" She looked at me inquiringly. I regarded the gap, which was maybe an inch and a half wide. "Probably not. Where does he like to hide? I wonder if I should call for Tommy to come." This wasn't the first bad one I'd seen, but it was the worst. Where was the social worker? She was supposed to meet me here, but then Tommy said she'd not been able to get across the threshold, had just seen enough to say that intervention was needed, and had called us because the cat was the first cited reason why Linda could not possibly go into more appropriate care. I wondered vaguely if the floors were safe. The second floor of a tenement building isn't where I would choose to store my 3 tons of crap. Linda was shuffling away again. She was old and frail, but she was surprisingly nimble negotiating the mess. She wandered away into a bigger room, either a bedroom or a living room. I followed her at a distance, painfully aware of my own weight as I approached the middle of the sagging, or was that my imagination, floor. Mountains of stuff rose up on all sides. In a nook made by several tables stacked on top of one another on one side, and a filthy wall with laths available under crumbling plaster on the other, there was a small pile of cushions and bedding. A filthy bare duvet was folded on top. I took in the grease marks on the wall and matched them to human anatomy, and my breath caught in my chest for a second. This was where she slept. "Did he sleep with you?" I asked. Linda regarded me vaguely again. "The cat," I added for clarity. "Oh, no, lassie. Not for a long time." She looked incredulous, as if I had asked her if he'd like to abseil. "No, for a long time." I looked around for a bowl or a tray that might have once contained cat food and saw so many half poking out from the mounds that I immediately just asked and said, "Where do you feed him?" She shuffled off again. "In the kitchen. But he must get an awful lot of nice fat mice, too. He doesn't seem to like the food I give him." Her voice trailed off. I followed her into the kitchen. It was quite something to behold. Food off, rotting in some cases, decayed to the point of desiccation, spewed out of carrier bags and black bin liners. Cupboard doors stood open or hung off their broken hinges. Scraps of paper were stuck to the small areas of visible floor. Small areas of grimy linoleum gummed up with cat hair showed in the gaps. Mountains of refuse formed the walls of another maze, which Linda rapidly negotiated. A dripping mass under a grimy window revealed itself to be a filthy sink full of festering pots and pans. Sheets of thick, bright orange and dull grayish mold formed skins on vile liquid in various mugs. A thick layer of dead houseflies lay on the sill. Next to that mess, standing on a disgusting hob of a filthy coker, was a tray with a huge mound of cat food in various states of decay on it. The freshest bits looked about a week old, and it just got worse from there. Maggots squirmed in the older-looking bits. The entire tray and the hob was literally sprinkled with rodent feces, both rat and mouse by the look of it. It seemed fairly unlikely that it was a cat that dined there. Linda, it was time to cut to the chase. When did you last see the cat? She screwed her face up. Monday, she replied, or wait, Friday. What day is this? It's Tuesday, the 7th of April, Linda. What month did you last see the cat? Do you recall? She squinted up at me, her dirty fingernails tapped out a disjointed rhythm on the edge of the cat food tray. Well, she said slowly, there was a lot of howling that one time. It was winter time because I remember the windows were all frozen over. At winter time? Do you mean a few months ago? She looked vague again. I tried to think back to when the most recent really cold snap was, but couldn't recall. Central heating and double glazing will do that to you. Okay, I tried again. Where was the howling? I was beginning to have that sinking feeling. No fresh droppings, no sign a cat had been eating. And though there was plenty of ammonia in the air, the normal sharp feline smell was not at all prominent. Still, you never knew. Oh, in the bathroom. Linda's face blazed with sudden clarity. In the bathroom. And the light worked then. But that was when I could get the door open. Before that, I could get the door open. Her face seemed frighteningly animated now, as if the memory had finally woken her up properly. Okay, but you think that might have been in the winter? I thought hard. The weather had been fairly bad all spring this year, but even so, not bad enough to freeze the windows, surely. And even then, it had been at least 3 weeks since anything approaching that chill. Unless a tap was dripping in there, the cat was dead. Thick ice on the windows. Linda sounded more sure than she had all along. I remember it. Thick ice. Oh, I and that bitch was supposed to visit me. But she didn't come. I waited and waited. So she didn't come. And me and her mammy freezing my slippers. She was supposed to bring me hers. She said it was too cold in here. She said so, but no, she didn't come. Not a fucking word as to why, neither. Not like her brother. He loves me. Very busy in his work. But he cares. Pays my power. Sends me messages every week. Never misses. Not even ever. He's my golden boy. That bitch doesn't care about nobody but herself. She trailed off again. Well, I really wish the social worker would show up. I guess we'd better see if we can get into the bathroom. But Linda, I'm afraid the cat might no longer be living. She looked completely unmoved at this information. It took another 20 minutes for me to establish that I definitely could not move the door, and to figure out that I might be able to unscrew the door hinges if we could find a screwdriver. This involved digging out and forcing open a drawer in the kitchen, but Linda's memory was surprisingly accurate as to the location of her cross-headed screwdrivers, and soon I was standing against the bathroom door again, three different sizes in my hand, trying to get an angle to get a screw turning. Linda was back to shuffling from room to room, muttering. I could only get 6 of the 9 screws out. The angle was too steep to access the others effectively. I could and had scratched them and scored them, but I couldn't loosen them. Still, with only 1 screw per hinge, hopefully I could ram it or lever it loose. I went back to the kitchen drawer and found the biggest flathead screwdriver in there to use as leverage. It was only a few minutes later when I'd managed to tear the remaining screws out of the frame and was holding the door, albeit still firmly wedged in place. The fingers of my right hand crushed between the frame and the door. Sweating, I angled the hinged side of the door away from me and was finally able to lift it out of the gap. It was heavy. I struggled to pull it out of the doorway and leaned it up against a heap of half-filled, half-collapsed cardboard boxes beside me and paused, panting. I turned back to the bathroom with some trepidation. The cat was almost definitely dead. There had been no movement the whole time I was wrangling with the door. I surveyed the scene. It took a while for my brain to make sense of what I saw. A pile of towels and large weights, lifting discs, had been blocking the door. Clothes, shoes, and a landslide of other sorted junk lay behind it, bracing everything against the foot of the cast iron bath. A moldy-looking old dark wig, braided, trailed out from under the weights. A baby car seat lay on its side a few feet away. My eyes took in the sweater lying with one sleeve stretched out towards the seat. I absentmindedly turned the seat around just as my mind registered the small bones on the floor near the sleeve. Finger bones. I looked at the seat and into small empty eye sockets, a third socket. The little open fontanelle was visible through a hole in the leathery skin. The seatbelt fastened loosely now around the once blue, now brown stained baby sleep suit. Tiny mummified hands curled one around the other, clasping each other for comfort. People are meant to scream at moments like this, but I didn't. I couldn't get a breath in. Linda was muttering in the distance, apparently disinterested now in the location of the cat. I stepped back from the scene, the horror of it all sliding together like a jigsaw as I did, bile rising in my throat. Luckily, right at that moment, both the social worker and Tommy, who had become concerned at my lack of update, decided to pop by. They were climbing the steps, and by the time I'd gotten a few breaths in and managed not to vomit, they were beside me, turning me away from the scene and making all the necessary calls. Once the police had arrived, I was taken to a neighbor's, where I drank strong hot tea with about 7 sugars in it and gave a nice young police officer a statement. She kept reaching over and patting my arm during my statement, giving at the inquest, I found out it was her first child death as a first attending officer. It was later established that the bodies had lain there several years, and probably since December of 2010, when there had been a very cold spell which did freeze windows. Linda's daughter had left an abusive partner and come back to Glasgow with her 7-week-old son, Elliot. She'd rented a small flat and had indeed come to collect her mother during the very cold snap. Although he paid the electricity, her brother had allowed the gas to be cut off because a house fire had seemed inevitable should a radiator get hot. It was never clear whether Linda had a clue she was in there or not. The coroner postulated that she may have been asleep when the daughter and baby arrived, and she seemed to have no knowledge whatsoever of her grandson, so she had written off his cries as those of a cat. While in the bathroom, a landslide of junk, which happened to have the heavy weights on top, had loosened and fallen, striking the daughter on the head. Her skull was severely fractured. Death, he said, would have been instantaneous. I thought of the arms stretched towards the baby seat and wondered. With nobody but Linda to miss them, no report was filed. Accidental death was ruled, and Linda was put into a nice care facility. I found the cat, by the way. It was rubbing around my legs as I gave my statement. The neighbor took it in 2009, 6 years before. Trying to feel normal again. I've worked as a corrections officer for just over a year now. I got into this business because I was a joke who failed out of college after 2 years. I went in with reservations, treating it just like a job, but I ended up falling in love with the job actually. For several months, I really enjoyed what I was doing. It sounds cliche, but I felt like I was making a change in my prisoners. My predecessor on B Block was a crooked piece of shit who had ties with Salvatrucha, and 2 people ended up dying because of him. So my equal opportunity approach was very much welcome in B Block. I felt like I belonged to community. I got along with my prisoners, but more importantly, I got along with the other officers very well. Because of this, I was so bummed when I was told that because of my people skills, I was being moved. I remember the conversation too. The higher-ups made it kind of a big thing and announced it in front of the other B-block officers. They said that because of my advanced interpersonal skills, I was to be moved to E-block. Now, two things happened once they announced this. I became confused because I had never even seen E-block, and the rest of the officers all looked at me with worried eyes. I kept quiet about it until I was alone with my superior in her office. So what is E-block? Is where we house prisoners that require special care, ones that must be monitored much closer, she interrupted me. Prisoners with health issues? I asked. She looked behind me, as if to make sure nobody else was listening. Okay, listen, we did not deceive you, but E-block isn't really talked about much. Not that shady shit goes down in terms of what the officers do, but because of the prisoners. E-block prisoners are prisoners that we consider dangerous. Yes, I know. D-block is where we house the violent ones. But just trust me, these guys are much worse, she said. As she was saying all of this, I could tell that her neck kept tightening. And while she was speaking in a calm voice, she looked nervous. For an entire week, I was given extra training and had to go through a second psych eval. One short course I had to go through was how to tell when you're being manipulated, so I could kind of tell what I was in for. E-block was on a lower level, just one level before the basement. The entire block looked spotless, though. Everything was pure white. The main room in the middle of the cells was much larger and had nicer furniture than the other blocks. It wasn't the fact that instead of metal doors, all four cells had glass doors. It wasn't that all the officers here were much more somber and serious. It wasn't the fact that the officer's lounge door was as heavy as a fucking vault. And it wasn't the fact that there were books labeled How to Handle Trauma and PTSD in the officer lounge that made me feel like I was in another world. No, it was when I received my equipment. Full riot gear. I was instructed to keep it all on, unless in the lounge. Gas mask had to be attached to my belt at all times. And an AR-15, when I first received this, Victor, the head officer there, said that if anything went wrong while I was on duty, kill the prisoner immediately. Do not waste time giving out warnings. That was when I figured out that I was in an entirely different world. Once I had my equipment, I received off-the-books training. Victor took me to every single cell and told me about each one. Tommy. His father was a well-known scientist in the late 90s. His father attempted to start up a machine he built himself, but instead it blew up. Tommy was the only family member to survive. 7 years later, in 2011, Tommy killed an elderly couple during a botched robbery on Christmas. Coroner said both victims' brains were liquefied. Tommy's cell, just like everyone else's, was pure white, but he had mirrors covering almost every inch of the walls. I was given one special instruction: never speak to him for more than a minute. Henry. I was shocked when I saw Henry. He was so tiny and innocent looking. That all changed when I was briefed on him. In 2009, at the age of 17, Henry terrorized a small town about 100 miles away from the prison. He killed and cannibalized 14 people. When officers apprehended him, he was able to literally crush two SWAT members to death even after being shot 3 times. When he was brought in, they didn't find a single drug in his body. His cell was normal, but I was instructed to make sure that he always had a pen and large notebook. He spent most of his time inside his cell and out, drawing. Paul. Paul was a much older man. Back in 2005, it was discovered that he had orchestrated the killing of 4 major crime bosses in New York City. But Paul never left his apartment for 2 months due to extreme agoraphobia while all these killings occurred. He never had any contact with anybody in any of the families and gangs. Yet when he called the police on himself, he knew every single detail of the crimes and could even draw the crime scenes perfectly. Hewitt. At the age of 23 back in 2004, Hewitt went to the country of Liberia, viewing it as a country where chaos reigned supreme, a modern Wild West. Well, it's not known exactly how he rose to power, but in 2008 it was discovered that Hewitt was the leader of a 70-person cult who ruled a good portion of the heroin trade. They were notably brutal in their tactics, allegedly sacrificing over 400 people. He was caught and extradited to the U.S. in 2012. His special instruction sent a chill down my spine. I was told that while I was within earshot of him, and he was using a comically deep voice, I was to put plugs in my ears and yell the word Omega into my radio. After I was introduced to everyone, I couldn't help but think I was being fucked with at first, but I promised to follow every single instruction laid out. We all had posts in that block. I sat on a chair right near the front entrance, which was on the right side of the room. I had an extremely easy job, watch the prisoners, and if any of them got upset, I was to gas them with a canister I'd been given on my first day through one of the holes on their doors. My job was a little trickier. While the prisoners were in the main room outside their cell, this was allowed for 2 hours a day, I had to make sure none of the prisoners got rowdy, and if one did, I was to gas every single prisoner. I gotta say, the first month was extremely boring. The prisoners seemed like zombies, so I didn't get to interact with them. Also, the E-Block team consisted of 10 officers, broken up into two shifts of 5 people who rarely ever talked to each other. And the only time I caught 2 of them speaking, they noticed me and immediately stopped talking. But all that changed about 2 days ago. Dear God, do I wish it had just stayed boring. New Year's Eve, while all of my friends were out partying, I was stuck at work watching Killer sit around and do nothing. I was extra pissed because this was the first time I had ever had to work a night shift. For reasons I will never know or understand, the higher-ups decided to switch us to nights. 10:35 was when it all began, and it began with me hearing Hewitt speak for the first time. "Why are you people here? You're not supposed to be here." He just randomly started screaming and banging on his door. I quickly got up and walked towards the door with a canister in my hands. The 3 other officers stationed around different places in the main room also got up from their chairs, and I heard the lounge door open right as I got to Hewitt's door. Time felt like it had slowed down as I locked eyes with Hewitt. It was the closest I'd gotten to him, and for the first time I finally saw him for what he was, an animal. Hewitt had the eyes of an animal, a beast. I raised a canister to one of the holes, but before I could spray, I heard Paul, who was in the second to last, yell out, "Nope," and clapped his hands. The lights went out. "What the fuck?" Hannah, one of the officers, yelled. "Turn the fucking lights back on," Victor yelled. "I'm trying, but they won't turn on." Gary, the officer, was always posted near the switches, yelled frantically. I began stepping back, and thank God I did, because only about 10 seconds after the lights went out, I heard the doors unlock and slide open. "Everybody, raise your weapons. Prisoners, do not move, or we will shoot," Victor screamed. My heart was racing, even with all the armor, the guns, and the backup. I felt completely vulnerable. My only solace was that I didn't hear any of the prisoners move. We have it set up so we can hear whenever the prisoners move around in their cells. The lights then switched back on. Every single prisoner was standing towards the back of their cells with giant grins on their faces. Hewitt was staring right at me. And if I looked in his eyes, though, I didn't see hate or anger. I saw what I can only describe as intrigue. Victor, who had moved towards the middle of the main room, made a beeline towards the lounge where the manual cell door buttons were. But as he reached the lounge door, the prisoners, in unison, began walking out of their cells, and then the lights cut out. I ran backwards and clenched my jaw. I felt like I was a squirrel that had somehow gotten into the lion cage. "Fire!" Victor screamed. For some reason, him yelling this made me even more scared. It was like the loud noise broke the tension and a wave of terror followed. I quickly turned off my safety and began shooting. The rest of the officers immediately followed suit, but instead of hearing screams of pain from the prisoners, all of them began laughing in unison. Then, using the sounds the floor tiles made, I heard all of them start sprinting towards us. The first scuffle I heard was only 10 feet to my left. I could hear what sounded like Henry and Gary fighting. I kept shooting, but also hoping that Gary would overpower Henry. My hopes were crushed when I heard Gary scream, followed by the lights turning on and seeing Henry holding Gary's head in his hands. But I didn't have time to mourn because Paul was sprinting at me from my left. I frantically raised my gun and shot Paul right in his throat. As Paul fell to the ground, the room began to shake, and these disembodied, blood-curdling screams filled the room. I stepped over Paul and shot him in the head, and the screaming stopped. Luckily for me, Victor and Hannah had killed both Henry and Tommy while I was dealing with Paul. I gained a false sense of security and threw up a thumbs up at Victor, who in turn screamed out, "Dominic, behind you!" I whipped around to see Hewitt whispering into a bloodied Miguel's, another officer's, ear. It looked like all the blood vessels had popped in Miguel's eyes because they were completely red. A grinning Hewitt got right behind Miguel as he slowly raised his gun at me. I couldn't hesitate, but goddamn, I wanted to so bad. You could see Miguel struggle against himself. I took advantage of this, and with tears in my eyes, I shot Miguel in his left eye. The second he fell, Hewitt scrambled towards me, arms stretched out, and a facial expression of pure hatred. I didn't think I would be able to raise my gun in time before Hewitt could grab it, but thankfully I didn't have to because Victor got off one in the middle of Hewitt's forehead. Hewitt fell right at my feet. All in all, the whole ordeal only lasted about 4 minutes. For a few minutes after it was all done and over with, the three surviving officers, Hannah, Victor, and I, all just kind of stood there for a couple of minutes, all just staring off into space. I can't speak for the others, but all I could think about was my family and how each close family member would react if I had died during that fight. Finally, Victor broke the silence. "Both of you go home. Don't come in unless you get a call from me personally telling you to come back." And we both did just that. I heard nothing all of Sunday and nothing Monday morning or afternoon. But at 6:30 last night, I heard a knock on my door. Standing outside my apartment was Victor. He looked like he hadn't slept. "Hey man, what's up?" I asked him. He looked me in the eye. Now that I got a closer look, I realized that he didn't look tired. He looked sad. "Listen, you can't come back to the prison. I'm really, really sorry. The prison has already transferred $2 million to your bank account. Plus, you've already been given amazing recommendations for a head officer job over at Lawrence Penn, which you can take whenever you like. But for now, please don't say anything." I didn't even get to respond before he just walked back down the hall towards the stairs. Of course, the first thing I did was look at my bank account, and sure enough, the money was there. I haven't been able to sleep. I can't stop thinking about seeing Henry holding Gary's head in his hands. I can't stop remembering feeling hunted. But most importantly, I can't stop thinking about just how hateful every single prisoner looked as they broke out. I'm going to call Lawrence eventually, but I feel like I need to get away. I'm going to book a cruise in a few hours and hopefully get the fuck out of here by the end of next week. I need to feel normal again. All names and places have been altered.